The first section of the Larapinta Trail is just under 23 kilometres long and starts at the old telegraph station where I met up with Alan Ginns, a planner with the Conservation Commission. He's one of the people involved in design and establishment of what's expected to be one of the most significant walks in Australia.
Obviously the question must be asked, why do people want to walk for 250 kilometres through the middle of the desert?
There's a lot to see in that desert, Ray. At the moment, the trail is planned for 210 kilometres, Alice Springs, through our main attractions, Simpson's Gap, Ellery Creek, Ormiston Gorge, finishing past Mount Razorback, past Glen Helen. But that will not be a single walk. We're designing it so that in 2 and 3 day stages, people can join and leave the track as they wish.
And apart from this main track, is there other things for people to do along this track?
Well, the Larapinta Trail itself will be like the backbone walk. There'll be shorter walks at places such as Simpson's Gap, Ellery Creek, perhaps 2 hour walks, perhaps half day or even a full day walk. But the Larapinta Trail will be the spine that weaves through all these walks.
There's already walks at places like Glen Ormiston with Ormiston Pound and those sorts of things. Are these going to be incorporated into the overall plan?
We're trying to link in with existing tracks as far as possible. But when you consider that our longest walk at the moment is a 4 hour walk at Ormiston Gorge, a 210 kilometre track is far more daunting undertaking.
What have been the major problems with putting the track in place so far?
We've identified a standard for the track, which is known as a Class B track, which means it's cleared to approximately a metre and has a certain grade limit. That is, it can't be steeper than a set gradient. Now, finding a route through the ranges that meets those criteria has been the most difficult at the moment.
So there's no climbing cliff faces and things like this?
No, that would tend to limit who could use the track. We're not trying to be too exclusive in the possible user groups. There are steps and there will possibly be ladders in some places, but nothing too daunting.
So, as you say, you're looking at over 200 kilometres of trail. That's a fairly significant trail, not just on Northern Territory standards, but on Australian standards.
Well, our intention is to make a track that will rate with the great walks of the world, Machu Picchu, the Appalachian Trail, the Milford Sound Track in New Zealand. We want to be up there with the great walks of the world, and I think we can achieve that.
One difference, this is hot and it's dusty and it's dry.
Safety is going to be a prime consideration. We're recommending a minimum amount of water that people should carry per person per day, and we're also setting a safety regime in place to look after walkers on the track. But the hotness, the dryness, the spectacular scenery adds to the experience.
Rightio, we're starting to talk here a little bit about equipment. To look at facing the Larapinta Trail or any part of the trail, what does a bushwalker need?
Obviously a good backpack and a good pair of boots. We're producing a brochure for every stage of the trail. We recommend that no one attempt the track without that brochure to guide them, to provide safety information, and to describe the country and the attractions they're walking through. Obvious things, a good hat, sunscreen, warm clothing, because despite being hot and dusty, Central Australia gets very cold in the winter. Extra food and water in case they're delayed at any point along their walk. A pair of binoculars, perhaps, our wildlife identikit for wildlife observation, plant identikit for plant observation, things to make their trip more enjoyable. I should say, with the market we're looking for in the track is the trekkers, the people that do the Himalayas, do the Milford Track in New Zealand. They're not really map and compass bushwalkers, or wilderness bushwalkers, if you like to call them that. We're after the people that don't mind carrying a load on their back, don't mind camping out, but enjoy the security of having a good route guide and a good well-marked track beneath their feet.
We mentioned water before. I've got my water bottle. Is that enough?
We're recommending 4 litres per person per day, Ray, so one water bottle, I'm afraid, won't be sufficient. 4 litres is the minimum recommended for people walking in an arid climate, and if you come from somewhere like Europe, because we're anticipating a high level of international visitors, we think that people from European and cold climates might require more. We're intending to provide water every second day, so the most that anyone has to carry will be a minimum of 8 litres, which is 8 kilograms. It's a hefty weight to have on the back, but walking in a desert, water is crucial.
Planning is a major factor in walking in this sort of terrain, and we've planned to walk to Wallaby Gap, a distance of just under 13 kilometres and the only established campsite on this section until you reach Simpson's Gap itself. It doesn't seem like much of a trip, and to many experienced bushwalkers it wouldn't be. However, we're taking our time to see a bit of the country up close, to listen to the birds, spot the wildlife, and in my own case, do a couple of interviews with Alan Ginns.
Alan, this section that we're walking along at the moment seems to have some special significance.
Well, as you can see right over the top of us is the old telegraph line, or a reconstructed section of it. This was the line put through between Adelaide and Darwin in the 1870s to link Australia into the international telegraphic network, and it was the prime reason for the European exploration and development of Central Australia.
So this is probably part of the earliest communication network in this part of the world.
Earliest European communication network, without a doubt. There was teams of explorers, construction workers, and then later the telegraph operators and linesmen living and working in Central Australia.
And how much of the trail follows the Overland Telegraph line?
We run underneath it for approximately a kilometre, and the wide path you can see beneath us here is actually the old North Road from Alice Springs to Darwin.
So this bit of gravel track was basically the main highway connecting north and south at one stage.
It saw everyone, horses and carts, drovers with sheep and cattle, and in 1907 it saw the first vehicle to cross from Australia north to south.
And I suppose looking at the condition of it, they can't have been travelling much quicker than we travel on foot.
I think we would have beaten them, right?
These ledges that we're going up through at the moment seem a bit unnatural. Are they formed steps for the trail?
Yeah, these were actually steps constructed by the Correctional Services work crews, Ray. Two purposes: to again control erosion on the track and to make it more passable. You'd notice that was a steep little section.
And if people are trying to climb it and that sort of thing, they're going to wear away the track themselves.
Well, firstly, people will wear away the track and it's hazardous for the user, and that's something we're trying to avoid.
The vegetation around here looks fairly distinctive and more or less common to all these hills around here. What is the vegetation growing in amongst this rock?
Scientists would call it a typical acacia shrubland, right? It's mainly mulga and witchetty bush as the larger shrubs. And underneath we've got Eremophila and cassia and small grasses and forbs on the ground.
The witchetty bush is quite a significant plant right throughout this landscape. How important is that to the landscape and to basically the environment around Alice Springs?
Well, witchetty is a good stabiliser and it's a typical part of the Alice Springs scenery. It's also the home of the large moth larvae that is known as the witchetty grub, which many of the tourists like to sample when they're in Central Australia.
And is this bush common all the way along the Larapinta Trail?
You'll find it on the hills and the lowlands right along the trail. The only place you really won't pick it up is in the high quartzite ridges, where the spinifex and the mallee eucalypts tend to dominate.
Alan, we're just down from the bridge over the Charles River here at a waterhole. There are waterholes marked on the map in places, but a lot of these waterholes aren't permanent.
Yes, most are semi-permanent. It's only the deeper holes in the gorges that are permanent, Ray. We're taking the track close to them because they are scenic areas, attractive areas to cool off for a swim.
We've got to the end of the first section, the telegraph station to Charles River section. We're now under the Charles River Bridge on the Stuart Highway, and the rest of the trail heads off towards Simpson's Gap. I've been up and down a couple of hills today, puffing a bit. How fit do you have to be to tackle the Larapinta Trail, or just some of these early sections?
Well, we've designed this section to be passable by people of average fitness, Ray. All it takes is a bit of common sense to pace yourself and enough stamina to carry the basic requirements of water and food for the trip.
But if you're looking for to take on the whole of the Larapinta Trail?
That you'd have to have a bit of background in bushwalking and be a reasonably fit adult, yes.
And be pretty well equipped.
Equipment is essential, otherwise we'd advise you not to take the track.
Thank you.
Coming up a small rise, we've been confronted by a tree full of small brown birds making quite a racket. These are the white-browed babblers, noticeable because of their narrow white eyebrow and white breast. Their noise makes them near oblivious to our presence. Shortly afterwards, we descended into one of the creek beds cutting through the range.
Well, this is one of the sandy creeks that drain south from Simpson's Gap, Ray. And as you can see, it's fairly dense tea tree thicket. If you break the leaves, it's rather aromatic as well, but it forms these rather dense thickets in the beds of sandy creeks that only flow perhaps once or twice a year.
And it seems to survive pretty well down here.
Very deep roots to get the underlying moisture out of the creek.
And of course that obviously holds it here when the creek runs as well.
Yeah, although the surface flow in the creek might stop after even hours and certainly days, there's a subsurface flow of water down these drainages for some time after rains.
One of the things that we have noticed walking the last couple of kilometres is seeing a couple of bullet holes in signs and a couple of shells. Obviously, since it is part of a park, firearms would be banned in it.
Yes, that's one of the unfortunate aspects, Ray. Firearms are prohibited in national parks, no doubt about that. But these people that do get on the track with firearms, not only damaging the signs, which costs us both time and money to get out and replace them, but they also propose a potential danger to other walkers on the track.
Yeah, it must be a bit worrying if you're walking along knowing that there's people with guns walking along the tracks as well.
Yes, we're trying range patrols when the track gets up and running to try and cut down on the problems we could have, but it is definitely a dangerous concern.
Almost immediately on leaving the creek bed, we heard the distinctive cry of the crested bellbird. Shortly afterward, we saw the bird itself sitting on a dead tree, its slender black crest raised and its broad black markings distinctive on its white breast.
If you take your time, walk slowly, don't rush the track, and even if you want a bit of a spell, sit down on a rock and you'll be surprised how close some of the small birds will come.
What about animals along here? We've obviously seen a fair bit of spoor from wallabies and that sort of thing around here.
Yeah, mainly euros in this hill country, euros and a fair amount of reptiles as well. You'll be lucky to see them, most of the wildlife's nocturnal, but as you said, there's plenty of evidence, euro droppings, euro pads that cross the track from time to time. So, like people, euros have their defined pads, the easiest tracks for them to take. Mm.
And so what's the best time to see these sorts of animals, both the euros and the reptiles? Early morning, late evening?
Early morning and late evening are the best for the euros and the mammals. In the cooler months, you see more of the reptiles basking on the rocks.
From here, it's all uphill to the top of Euro Ridge. But for that, well, you'll just have to wait till next week. Was this your idea, Jinzy? From here it's on to the longest climb of this section of the trail, the climb up Euro Ridge. The rocky and sometimes loose trail make this section difficult, but not impossible, and certainly worthwhile.
I'll have to excuse the huffing and puffing, but this is one of the highest points on the walk so far.
Yeah, we're about 780 metres, Ray, which is approximately 200 metres above the level of Alice Springs.
What is this? It's quite an incredible looking geological formation here.
Euro Ridge is an upstanding ridge of quartz and schist, and the geology of this site is quite interesting. We're actually standing on the Charles River Fault. About 350 million years ago, which is really, for my mind, a hard period of time to grasp, there were massive earth movements in this area. Basically, what happened under intense compression, a slab of rock was thrust tens of kilometres to the south, overriding or sliding over the rock beneath it. This was then, in this area, bowed up into a massive arch. And what we're actually standing on here is one of the eroded sides of the arch. The valley floor beneath us, it's hard to imagine, was actually once the core of that huge hill. And this is after the process of erosion over hundreds of millions of years, this is one of those stumps of that side of the hill.
Mount Gillon on the other side of the valley is the other stump.
I suppose it's a bit hard to describe to people on radio, but where we're actually sitting here, a metre away, it drops off, what, 200 metres?
Yeah, I'd say she'd be a good 100 metre drop, Ray, just about 3 feet behind me.
But, of course, one of the things that this does do is it gives us spectacular views.
Oh, 360 degrees view here, Ray. Up to 65 kilometres we can see from this point, Mount Loughlin over there to the, well, to the northeast, and Mount Conway back behind us to the west is 40 kilometres away. So really probably one of the grandest views on this section of the walk.
And of course we get this great view of the Western McDonald's over there, and places like Mount Gillon that are really outstanding features, and we even have a pretty good view of Alice Springs itself.
Yeah, Alice Springs is spread out there in all its glory through Heavy Tree Gap again, but it really gives you a feel for the enormity and the size of the country around here, right? We're only, as the crow flies, 7k from Alice, but you can see for miles.
This was one of the areas that had to be cleared by the Aboriginal custodians before the Conservation Commission could put the park through it. Why was that?
Well, there's an Aboriginal dreaming story that runs right through this area, Ray. Euro Ridge is actually named after the Euro Dreaming, or the Arunga Dreaming, as it's known to Aboriginal people, that runs through here. The story is of an ancestral Euro being that in the dream time travelled from Stanley Chasm, approximately 35 kilometres to our west, along the line of this ridge, to approximately where the Alice Springs Telegraph Station is, where we started from.
We've been talking about the height and the sheer cliff face and what a superb view that gives you, but there are some problems with safety up here?
Well, as you can see, Ray, the track runs within a metre or two of that 100 metre drop in places, so although the view is unbelievably and superb, I'd still ask people to keep their eyes on the track, just take a bit more precaution along this section, otherwise we might have to do a medical evacuation, and that's the last thing we really like.
Yeah, especially from the bottom of a 100 metre to fall.
Sometimes it gets a bit pointless after a 100 metre fall, right?
Yeah.
From the top of Euro Ridge to our overnight camping spot is only a couple of kilometres. To get to the ground, we pass the mouth of Wallaby Gap, a cool, tranquil spot after the heat of the day. The campground is set up with a water tank, a fire pit, and a couple of low wooden tables. Two things are noticeable. Firstly, the campground is some distance, about 300 metres from the prettier area at the mouth of Wallaby Gap, and secondly, firewood is at a premium.
Rightio, Alan, we've got to the campsite at Wallaby Gap. It's not actually in Wallaby Gap, it's some 100 to 200 metres away from Wallaby Gap itself. Why is the campsite put this far away from what's really quite a pleasant spot?
Three reasons essentially, Ray. Firstly, we saw the waterhole in Wallaby Gap. That's an important watering point for the native animals around this area. And by camping people too close to that, you deter the animals from coming in where the people were to water overnight. Secondly, as you can see, the campground takes up a reasonable amount of area because we're trying to space people out around the flat here so they're not camping on each other's doorstep. So we need more space than is available in Wallaby Gap. And thirdly, for the flood risk, a sudden storm could put anything up to 2 feet of water down Wallaby Gap, and we really don't want people in sleeping bags in front of that sort of thing.
Right, yeah, well, we've got a sort of decent sort of fire going ourselves here tonight, but obviously there's not a lot of dead timber around the place. Is this lack of firewood a problem right throughout the trail?
It's going to be one of the management issues we have to face. We'd prefer it if walkers carried gas stoves for cooking on. Cooking does consume a lot of the wood around the place, but we acknowledge that people do want to sit around a campfire, and in that case we'd ask that they use the minimum amount of wood possible and save some for other users. So it's gas stoves for cooking and a small fire just for the experience.
You're starting to add weight, of course, and a lot of people would argue that they'd prefer to dig up a bit of firewood than carry the weight of a gas fire across this sort of terrain.
That is an argument, but you can get gas stoves down to anything weighing half a kilo at the moment, Ray, and I just stress that even though it's fallen dead wood, it's still important habitat for smaller animals such as reptiles and especially insects, and it also is a seed store for the regeneration of the species, so there is an environmental impact from using too much fuel wood.
Overnight, a few spots of rain have cooled the country down considerably. The 10 kilometres from Wallaby Gap to Simpson's Gap take us for the first part along the southern foothills.
As you can see, Ray, we've run off a high exposed ridge with very low vegetation into these low rolling foothills and alluvial flats where the vegetation's much more dense and much more varied. We're moving from witchetty bush shrubland through to open woodlands with mulga and ironwood. So there's quite a greater variety of plant life on this side of the range.
I suppose one thing that the listeners can hear too is that the weather's certainly changed. Yesterday we had temperatures up to 38 degrees and fairly still. Today, reasonably cool with some wind and a bit of drizzle as well. Are these sorts of quite great changes in climate likely to anyone walking along the Larapinta Trail?
They do happen from time to time in Central Australia. Temperature can drop 20 degrees in a matter of a few hours. So we do ask that people carry enough clothing for such contingencies.
Alan, obviously not all the scenic attractions on the Larapinta Trail are actually on the trail itself. Some of them are just off. Here we see a sign that says 300 metres away there's the Scorpion Pool. First of all, Scorpion Pool, what is it?
It's basically a crevice in the ridge, Ray, that holds water for a short period after rain. There's also an interesting semi-permanent spring. This area was originally underlaid by limestone, and that acts as a bit of a sponge. The water permeates out of the limestone here into a semi-permanent rock pool.
So a good spot for bird watching and the like?
Well, semi-permanent water holes always attract things like zebra finches and other bird life coming into water, so it is a good spot to sit quietly and do a bit of bird watching.
Scorpion Pool, where'd the name come from?
That's from insect that looks rather similar to a scorpion, but it's actually not the same family. It hangs inverted in the water. They're about an inch and a half long, I suppose, and breathe in a most interesting fashion through a pipe that actually comes up from the back of the abdomen.
And these are the sort of things that people would see in these semi-permanent waterholes?
They're timid little insects, but if they do sit quietly by the waterhole, they'll probably see them feeding around the edge of the hole.
And this attitude of having the trail a bit away from the foothills here and letting people go off on their own and explore some of these little gaps and gorges, is that going to be a feature of the whole trail?
Yeah, in some places we're not going to run into main features of interest, but rather let people explore them carefully by themselves. We wouldn't recommend people to go wandering too far off the track, but here it's an easy walk to follow the creek up to Scorpion Pool. It's 300 metres. Most people can handle a 300 metre hike off track.
The climb begins again onto Rungachurva Ridge, an area totally different to any previously travelled through. For a start, the vegetation is dense and high.
What's caused this sort of landscape? There's obviously a lot of quartz in that here.
Yeah, we're actually in the scree slope, or the foothills of Rungachurva Ridge, which you can see towering behind us, Ray. Spectacular orange cliffs, anything up to 400 or 500 feet high, at least. And we're on the scree slope that's slowly been eroded off that more resistant quartzite face. And it's also a sheltered habitat, protected from fire, and that's why we're in the middle of this dense mature mulga grove that hasn't been burnt for decades, I'd say.
Yes, obviously the vegetation from when we were down on the flats, you're looking at vegetation that was maybe coming up to head high. Here it's actually quite tall and quite thick.
It's a very interesting area actually, Ray. You see the small withered looking little fern underneath our feet, that's actually resurrection fern. For all intents and purposes it looks quite dead, but one good rain on that and that'll come back very bright green and as alive and kicking.
A negative aspect of the trail realised over the last couple of days is the presence of a single rider on a trail bike who's been ahead of us by a few days. The damage done to the trail by this rider is noticeable and considerable.
Yeah, we've seen the up and down country we've been walking through for the last kilometre, race, and fairly steep little climbs and steep descents. And just the one trail bike on that has cut the surface up quite considerably. It's pulled out some of the steps that we've put in place. And the track marks left by the trail bike are starting to erode out already with just a few rains on them. So it's amazing the amount of damage that a single trail bike can do to a walking path.
And obviously one, the fact that it's broken the surface and made the surface loose has in parts already made it reasonably dangerous to walk on.
Well, not only dangerous for walkers to walk on, Ray, but encountering a trail bike coming at speed in the opposite direction is a potential hazard.
So what sort of facilities do you have for controlling trail bike riding then?
Mainly education in the first instance, advising trail bikers around town that there are other places that aren't national parks and used by walkers that are available for trail bike riding. And secondly, unfortunately, we have to get down to fencing the park and actually advising trail bikers that we find on park that trail bike riding unfortunately is prohibited.
Out of the Mulga we come to Hat Hill Saddle, a low ridge joining Hat Hill and the orange cliffs of Rangachurba Ridge.
Yeah, two things come here on this enter in this part of the trail, Spinifex, as you say, and Blue Mallee and some Coolabah.
And up on the ridge itself, you can see some in some of the crevices there, some cycads.
Yes, we saw a cycad back at Wallaby Gap, but there are good stands of cycads along the base of Rangachurba Ridge. Actually, this area is one of the biologically important parts of Simpson's Gap. Not only do we have cycads and good stands of native cypress pine, but at the base of the ridge again is Ricinocarpus gloria medii, glory of the centre, is its common, or one of its common names. And until a few years ago, this was the only known colony of this small shrub in the world. Since then, we found two smaller colonies in the East McDonald's at around Trofina. But it is a significant area for that fact.
The path curves around the face of Hat Hill down to Simpson's Gap, a significant landmark in Central Australia, but for us, the end of our walk over this first section. A bit of good timing means we don't have long to wait for our lift, a good point, since it's a long walk home if you haven't arranged for one beforehand.